I will introduce our guests for today, and they will take over. If you can't hear, tell them there is a microphone in case they wish to use it. I'll turn it on. It won't. If you're going to use it, you need to be up this close to it. Okay. Mary Beth and Tony, will you come up here? Is that the best? Yeah. And I'll go sit in the audience in a minute. I'll announce Tony. Tony will announce Mary Beth. We'll introduce Mary Beth, and then off we'll go. There will be a lot of opportunity for questions, yeah?
Almost the whole time.
Okay, so if you have questions, that's what this is about. So, many of you know Mary Beth, who is a class member and comes regularly to class. Her husband is Dr. Anthony Goodman, who has spoken to us once last year, and it was way too brief. It was last year, I think.
Was it last year?
I think so, yeah.
Yes.
And it was so brief that I thought, oh God, I got him, if he ever comes back. Okay, so let me give Tony a formal introduction, and then he'll give Mary Beth a formal introduction, okay? Dr. Anthony A. Goodman, is adjunct professor of medicine at Montana State University and affiliate professor in the Department of Biological Science at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He earned his BA from Harvard College and his MD from Cornell Medical College, and trained as a surgical intern and resident at the University of Michigan Medical Center in Ann Arbor. He completed his surgical training and served as chief resident at the Harvard Surgical Service of Boston City Hospital, the New England Deaconess Hospital, the Leahy Clinic, and the Cambridge City Hospital. For 20 years, Dr. Goodman worked as a general surgeon in South Florida and served as clinical associate professor of surgery at the University of Miami School of Medicine. In addition, he served as a surgeon with the U.S. Army Medical Corps and on the hospital ship for Project Hope. He was also visiting professor of surgery at the Christ Church New Zealand Clinical School of Medicine. Founder of the Broward Surgical Society, Dr. Goodman is a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and a diplomate of the National Board of Medical Examiners and the American Board of Surgery. Those of you who know the Great Courses series through the Teaching Company, Dr. Goodman has four courses on the Great Courses. They are Understanding the Human Body, an Introduction to Anatomy and Physiology, The Human Body, How We Fail, How We Heal, Lifelong Health, Achieving Optimum Well-Being at Any Age, and The Myths of Nutrition and Fitness. You can find more about that at thegreatcourses.com, is the website, thegreatcourses.com. Just a personal part to the introduction. Last year's, the presentation that Mary Beth and Tony gave last year was so clear and so helpful that I am beyond delighted to have them back to enlighten us further. And if you don't have any questions, I have a whole hour's worth. Hopefully.
Thank you.
Can you hear me in the back or in the microphone? Okay. Mary Beth doesn't come with that CD printed out, but I can tell you she's the brains behind the whole thing. She's my partner in putting all these together, and the joke at the Teaching Company is that I'm just a pretty face that they put in front of the TV camera, and it's Mary Beth they really hire. So we work on all these together, including other projects. I'm going to be very brief. What I want to do is go over what we talked about last time. How many of you were here? An idea of who's new to this. Okay. Just very quickly tell you what we covered and what's new, and then just open up for all your questions. I'd rather just answer what questions are on your mind. I just ask you don't ask personal medical questions, because it just isn't fair to the whole group, and probably not proper for me to address those publicly anyway. So, last time in the lifelong health course, we talked about aging and dying. which is odd to start off with, but it was really only because we didn't want to end with that in our course. This was 36 lectures. We talked about nutrition as opposed to dieting, creating a good pattern of nutrition. We talked about fitness and movement, had a whole section on that. Each of these were 6 or 7 lectures. And then lifestyle in general, mindfulness and meditation, and then also specific topics such as women's issues, men's issues, and children's issues. And trying to get a whole system of making and developing a lifestyle that you can work with. And the main points that we talked about throughout this and apply to pretty much what we feel about anything you're going to do to improve your life and your health and your way of being in the world, there are several key factors that really work, I think, and only work if you use them. And the first one was what we call the Goldilocks theory. And that is, you really have to try everything until you get the one that suits you. And it may not be the one that suits other people or the geniuses that are telling you what to do. You, when it comes to, for example, body movement, you really have to, or it would be best to find something you really enjoy that satisfies all the needs you want to get out of that kind of movement and fitness, rather than the drudgery, if it's drudgery to you, to get on a treadmill or do what's prescribed to get so many minutes per week of exercise. So trying out what feels good will allow you to keep on going with a certain amount of joy. We then talked about the 1 degree of change. When you want to move into new areas that you may not have tried before, don't make an enormous change in your life, like starting a new diet and dropping from 2,000 calories to 500 calories. It's not going to work, it's not going to last, and most people fail when they do this. We talked about how a shift that changes course by 1 degree, just 1 degree, will be in a few hours pretty much where it was on course before, but over time, it's going to end up at a whole different place from where it had started out. And that applies to whether you're making positive changes or negative changes. It only takes a little bit to change your course and give you lots of dividends or make things a lot worse for you. If you make changes that are not beneficial. And then again, we've evolved, our bodies have evolved over the millennia to like moderation. Going to extremes doesn't usually work. It's not usually good for the body. So we want to think about making changes moderately and living our whole life in a moderate way. And it will fulfill the bill in both health, nutrition, almost everything else you want to do. And the other thing is, you can't fool Mother Nature. Remember the ad, where it was butter and margarine, and they were out, Mother Nature had her garland in her gowns, and she said, "Oh, this is delicious butter." And they said, "No, Mother Nature, it's margarine." I said, "No, it's butter, it's too good." "No, it's margarine." And the clouds opened and lightning came down and thunder and everybody cowered. And she said, "It's not nice to fool Mother Nature." And you're not going to get away with it. You can't fool Mother Nature. Most of the hype, whether it's fitness, whether it's nutrition out there, is not going to work if you disobey certain rules that have evolved to benefit us. When you go against those, you usually end up failing in what you want to do. And finally, we talked a lot about the myths of aging, and our, as a society, let's just stick with America and Europe, Western society, has really had a hard time dealing with the whole issue of death and aging. And we don't want to face it. D.T. Suzuki, anybody familiar with Suzuki? He said that living is like setting to sea in a boat that you know is going to sink. And the other more extreme that people have said is, we are condemned to death from the time of our birth for the crime of living. And yet, in this society, Western society, we really don't like to talk about it, we don't like to face it, and we fear it. And so we spent a lot of time talking about the way we deal with death in this country and perhaps better ways to do that.
Can I just jump in here?
Yeah, please.
And the reason we talked about death in particular was because it really compels our fear of aging and our denial of aging and what we then do to our bodies to make us look younger, feel younger, and our fear of aging. So once a culture fully embraces death and dying, we don't have to fear aging. And you'll see in indigenous cultures where they honor the elders as the wise ones. And those are usually cultures that don't have the fear of death and dying. So we felt this was a very important part to include in a lecture of lifelong health, that we needed to talk about this as well.
So I thought there'd be many more of you who were here last time, and since there weren't, I'm going to read to you Woody Allen's very famous quote, which I just learned recently. There's great debate whether he wrote this for George Carlin, but it's essentially the same. He wrote, "In my next life, I want to live my life backwards. You start out dead and get that out of the way. And then you wake up in an old person's home feeling better every day. You get kicked out of that for being healthy. You go to collect your pension, and then you start work. You get a gold watch and a party on your very first day. You work for 40 years until you're young enough to enjoy your retirement. You party, you drink alcohol, and are generally promiscuous, and then you're ready for high school. And you go to primary school, you become a kid and you play. You have no responsibilities, you become a baby until you are born. And then you spend the last 9 months floating in a luxurious spa-like condition with central heating and room service on tap, larger quarters every day, and then voila, you finish off as an orgasm." So, for my favorite guru, Woody Allen. So that's where we are now. We also, just about a year ago, we take this course, which is the new set of courses we're going to have at the Great Courses, that are very short, only 6 lectures on compact subjects. And in this one is called the Myths of Nutrition and Fitness, which if you want to afterwards you can take a look at the perspective that I brought in. And this was a lot of fun because it had to be very compact and we had to get a lot of information into just 6 lectures. And it's not the myths of nutrition and the myths of fitness. It's the myths of nutrition and fitness together, how they impact each other. And we talk about fueling for your body movement, for your fitness program, hydration for those same things, the skinny on weight loss and dieting and exercise, and then a lot of the myths of vitamins and supplements, which are huge. Too much of a good thing, things like bulimia, excessive skinniness, there are people who are actually exercise addicts. And then going to extremes, how to deal with high and low altitudes, hot environments, cold environments, and so on, and how they work in both nutrition and fitness together. And that's just been out since September, so we've enjoyed making it and seeing it get very, very good popularity. So the only other areas that we don't address here and didn't last time was the importance of sleep, because it's becoming more and more clear that the vast majority of Americans do not get enough sleep, and it's very adversely impacting their health. And then finally, the idea of nutrition, and I said not dieting, and going back a little bit to the Greek definition, dieta, which is a way of being, that our diet, our food, and our nutrition, as opposed to dieting to lose weight, should be a way we eat, not exactly specific diets to lose weight or gain weight or whatever you want to do. So with that,
I want to add one more thing. The other key piece is listening to your body and learning how to listen in terms of the Goldilocks, what fits you and what fits you now today in this moment. And when I talked with people about how we'll eat, isn't the best way of eating. Like, you would, you think we're vegetarians and we eat all this healthy food. Tony will tell you later what he ate on the way over here. I mean, I will, a chocolate donut. So this is not like being good or bad. This is really listening to what the body's wanting. And that's where the mindfulness comes in. And that's why we have a whole lecture on mindfulness. And so I appreciate Spencer's teaching it. Really saying, does my body feel active today? Does it feel quiet today? Does it feel hungry? Does it feel that I don't need food today? And somebody asked me, well, how do I know I'm not just doing emotional eating or compensating because I'm angry? Well, that's part of the mindfulness. I mean, I know when I get angry and frustrated, I go for corn chips. I can't have them in the house. I mean, I cannot have them in the house because they're just great for just working out the anger. So I know I'm mindfully doing it, but I'm doing it. So what I'm saying is that the listening to your body piece runs through the entire course.
Yep.
And maybe if you could just speak to the sense of how we perceive ourselves and the story we tell ourselves and your own story.
Well, I think it's a lot of people's story, but I, especially now, I'm 72 and I hear a lot of my friends. Oh, you're just
holding your head. I'm just poised the
rest. A lot of my friends at this age, I hear the constant refrain about how awful it is to age, how we're getting older, and this is failing and that is failing. And I'm trying to encourage them to look at it as an opportunity to get better at things, to improve. And one of the great pieces of research that's been done in the last 10 years was done at the Beth Israel Hospital's nursing home in Boston. There's always been the idea and the myth that at a certain point you can no longer maintain, or and especially not gain, muscle power, bulk, strength, endurance. That's totally false. There now seems to be no age at which you can't improve. And they took a bunch of people in their 90s at the nursing home, some bedridden, some with walkers, definitely people who were atrophied muscular abilities, and they put them on a program which makes it a very easy study to do, because if you want to test strength, you can test range of motion, can be measured. The amount of weight is easy to measure, and the number of repetitions you can do is easy to measure. So they took a group and they took a control group. They did a double-blind controlled study of these people, and they had these wonderful pictures I saw on a video. They're in there, the nursing home, and the guys are pumping iron like this, and they can barely see that, and they're smiling, too. And at the end of only a few weeks, they had markedly improved muscle mass, strength, endurance. And then the secondary observation was that the bedridden patients were up and out of bed, and the ones with the walkers who got rid of their walker, and the ones that were falling were no longer falling. So there's really no limit that you can, there's no age limit that says, now's when I start to deteriorate. And we try to make this an important part of our lives, and I know that I'm physically stronger than I was 10 years ago once I decided that was possible. And, you know, I've gone back to doing chin-ups as one of my activities, which usually is the first thing that people stop doing. There's another thing I'm not going to get into too much today called HIIT, High Intensity Interval Training, which you may want to look up. It's also called SIT, S-I-T, which sounds the opposite of what it should be, which is Sprint Interval Training. It's the same thing. It's now replacing these long hours they're recommending, they used to recommend, on treadmills or life cycles or walking or exercise, where you're doing 30, 40, 50 minutes several times a week, and getting, you know, aerobic training. This is all totally anaerobic training, and it amounts to 4 minutes, 4 to 8 minutes, three times a week. And it will get you far more, they've measured this, it's easy to measure, far more than an hour a day, 5 days a week. And it wasn't developed to try to reduce the amount of time you have to work out. It was done by athletes, for example, very high intensity levels, like rowing teams, college coaches, coach rowing now, are all going over to this. The Germans led the way in this way back in the 60s. And what you do is you exert yourself any way you want Doesn't matter whether it's jumping jacks or rowing or running or swimming or skipping, but you have to go so hard that you're right up at your maximal heart rate for 30 seconds. You're pushing into the anaerobic phase where you're gasping, where you really can't go beyond that 30 seconds. So if you could keep doing this for 4 minutes, you're not going hard enough. And then you rest for only 30 seconds. This is one protocol. And that does not allow your heart rate to come down too much. And then you do another set, and you do anywhere from 4 to 8 of these 3 times a week. And the results are just shocking in 2 to 3 weeks. The things you can measure, your resting heart rate comes way, way down, which is a good thing. Your maximal heart rate goes up. Your recovery time becomes more rapid. And all the measures of fitness are improved. Now, the big caveat is that most of us who are over 25 here really got to be careful about doing this. Number one, you really ought to check in with your doctors. The problem is most doctors don't know about this training, so you really have to be very selective. If you've got any kind of fitness or health problem, you really should go at this very, very carefully. But this is, again, the whole big change that's allowed people who thought, for example, it was always thought that if you want to know what your maximal heart rate was, you probably all remember this. You took 220 and you subtracted your age, minus 72. So I should, my maximal heart rate should be 148. We always thought that was all the heart could do. And it was dangerous to go above that. Well, I routinely now go to 175 in this HIIT training. And that scared me, so I did it with EKG running, I did it on a treadmill with a cardiologist, and I did it with what's called a VO2 max, the oxygen extraction test, where they're monitoring your cardiac function all the time, and no problems. In many years of this at McGill, they've done studies even with post-coronary patients who have benefited from it. But again, big warning, don't do this without at least some supervision. Expert supervision. Any questions about that?
We're just opening up.
We deal with people who have midlife crisis. I think I have a midlife crisis. I'm somewhere 56.
I'm sorry, and what is the question?
I keep getting midlife crisis and I'm 56.
So
I'm
not
understanding that.
She asked about what you do about midlife crisis.
Gosh.
I'm 56, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's a bit of an issue. In terms of taking care of your body first, getting sleep, eating well, and exercising, and really maintaining a moderate lifestyle is one of the key foundational pieces.
The thing is, I have phobias and I don't like to be alone, and I think a lot of flashes too.
Yep, I understand.
You have a lot of company in the room. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the sprint interval training. What do you recommend for the exact exercise? And I say that because I'm worried about joints, about jogging and that kind of thing. Because I've done I've heard this before and I started doing jump rope, but I can't answer.
Those are all very hard on the joints. You can do, it doesn't matter what the exercise is. That's what's so beautiful about it, because as long as it gets your heart rate up. So you have to find what's good for you. There are lots of things that spare the joints, like rowing machines, cycling, swimming. It's an individual choice. It's anything that gets that heart rate up.
And 4 minutes.
The protocol I use is 4 minutes. And then I've actually moved it up to 8 minutes, but it's 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off. You absolutely rest for those 30 seconds. You should probably wear a heart monitor. There's something you'll read about if you go to the internet, which I'm sure a lot of you are going to do now. And if you look up HIIT, or high intensity interval training, you'll see something called the Tabata protocols, named after a Japanese physiologist, Tabata. And his was one of the first to be very well studied. And his are 20 seconds on, 10 off. Well, that sounds easier, but it's not, because that 10 seconds is really short. And that's probably something the high level athlete should do more than one of us. And there's another one called the 4x4, which is 3 minutes on and 1 minute off. Yeah, 3 minutes on, 1 minute off for 4 repetitions. But most people cannot reach anaerobic maximum for 3 minutes. That's a very long time. And so you're probably not reaching what this was designed to do. You're probably actually better off with 30 seconds and then a 30-second rest.
Well, if I'm running, just my personal experience, if I'm running slowly, it jars. But the faster I go, the smoother and the less impact there is. Does that conform to what you believe?
Well, I don't know the answer to that specific question, but I'll tell you the newest information I have on running. And that is a recent study by the orthopedics kind of put to rest something that we've all heard for so long, that running is awful for your joints, too much impact, and it hurts your back, and then most of us have to give up running at a certain point. What they found when they studied this was it probably has nothing to do with running. There are many, many people who run 100 marathons, and they're in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, who have perfectly normal joints. And there are couch potatoes who've never run a day in their life who have horrible joints. It seems to have something to do with the individual's joints and not the sport.
One last thing. If you're from school, you're probably aware of a book by Noel Bowerman. He's a legendary track coach. He's an artist of Running with Style. He calls Steve Fontaine. Well, Prefontaine, one of the most famous. It's a teaching little book. It teaches you that there's only about 3 things you got to do right to run smoothly. So, okay. Bill Bowerman, Running with Style.
Bill Bowerman, Running with Style. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard a couple other presentations on this interval training. And one of the most recent one said there was a study that showed you've got effective training of the cardiovascular system with 30 seconds on, 4 minutes off cycling. And it was like 3 times a week and less than 15 minutes total. And the other thing was that the other presentations always emphasize gradually building up your heart rate. So you don't just start this cold turkey in one day.
No,
you work up to the intensity level gradually.
Right, both the intensity and the number of repetitions. When I started trying to get to eight, I started doing one. I took a breath, then I took a rest period and added them. And then when I got to doing 2, and then a longer rest, and then did 6 at lower intensity, I kept adding them that way over a period of months.
Right.
And also the intensity, I didn't start off with my heart rate at 175, but worked up to that.
Exactly.
And that's going to be a very individual thing. The number of different programs is still evolving, whether the extreme Tabata protocol, or the 4x4, or the one you're mentioning. I don't think we have the answer which is the best, but the information I see is that you're better off with fewer and higher intensity as long as you're not having heart problems.
Yeah.
So I wanted to shift from the exercise, because for some people, this, for you and I, this fits really well, for some of us, but for some of us, we're not going to do this. So the question is something that affects all of us, which is supplements.
Okay.
What ones do we have? Should we all take? What ones should we all stay away from? You know, general philosophy, but also recommendations for particulars, because we're all totally confused.
Okay. I'm not usually a therapeutic nihilist, but I am when it comes to supplements and vitamins. There's no evidence ever in any well-known study that vitamins are any good for anyone. Now, special cases, pregnant women, young children who are eating terribly, people who have other diseases, sure. But for the average person, they've done these 30 and 40 year studies with hundreds of thousands of people, including the Good Women's Health Study, has never shown any benefit to taking vitamins. No harm, probably, but no benefit. Second thing, most of the supplements are a waste of time and money, and some of them are downright dangerous. The biggest example is beta-carotene. The commercial part of the industry took a little bit of information and then expanded it into an industry. Beta-carotene is a naturally occurring free radical suppressor. It's an antioxidant, and it's very effective in nature. So they put it into a capsule form, and they started selling it very successfully. And then when they finally got someone to do a study, what they found was not only did it do any good, but it was killing some patients, and they had to prematurely stop the study. lung cancer patients, their disease went out of control when they got on the beta carotene. There's about 160 carotenes in nature, and they're combined to be very effective in nature. But singling out one doesn't make any sense, and you can't measure these free radicals, you can't measure your antioxidants. So again, it's an industry that's just trying to sell you something. The problem is, it's very hard to get studies done, because all of these are in nature, so you can't patent them. These are multi-million dollar studies to get anything effective done, so nobody's going to fund these studies. I generally say that there are very few supplements that you actually need unless you have a horrendously unbalanced diet. The two exceptions that have been proven worthwhile, one is the purified fish oils, the omega-3 fatty acids. The studies, one after another, are coming up positive on this. Full disclosure, I take it every day in a liquid form. You've got to be a little careful, as with any medication, to be moderate. I had a friend, otherwise very intelligent person, taking the bottle of liquid fish oil and swinging it down at me. Well, it has an anticoagulant effect, and that can get out of hand. So you really have to follow the labels, get high quality, purified stuff. Or you got salmon and help. It's another good way. And then the other one that's probably important is calcium and vitamin D, especially in people around most of our ages, and especially in postmenopausal women. The problem came up about a year ago with some small studies showing patients on increased calcium supplements were having more cardiac problems, especially in the men, and that's still under investigation. Again, I would stick with your doctor's recommendation and your particular individual Goldilocks situation. And if you, for example, have no osteoporosis of any kind or osteopenia, and don't need the calcium supplement, you don't need to take it. But if you are at risk, I think calcium and vitamin D probably good supplements. Again, within those. The rest of them, creatine and all these other supplements, are just big multi-billion dollar money makers. No science behind them.
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Well, I think it helps to cap the tint for my anxiety and just help me with the side effects. It makes me more jittery and makes me have more phobias and makes me itch all over. And then I take too many and that makes me side effects. And it makes my hand and face tremble. And then it makes my phobias worse. And it gives me even like crisis and hot flash. And then it makes me more depressed and lonely.
Well, that's good that you're getting off of it.
I'm not getting off, but...
Oh. Well, I have to refer you to your own doctor who's giving you that.
What do you mean by that?
Pardon?
What do you mean by that?
You have to let your doctor take care of that. I can't handle that for you.
Okay? I don't want to think about it, right?
No, you're someone else's patient. I can't get into that.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's okay.
Would you talk a little bit about integrative medicine?
Okay.
What's your definition of integrative medicine?
It's a combination of Western medicine and other modalities.
And that's how we spoke to it in Lifelong Health, in terms of using acupuncture or using other forms of body work, other herbal supplements, which we don't encourage. But there's a lot recently, it just came out recently, about some of these studies with the National Institute of...
It was in last week's Berkeley Health newsletter.
Yeah. That some of their studies, unfortunately, from some of the integrative modalities, have not been as clear as they probably could have been.
Not as well controlled.
And so there's, the debate is still on. I personally use acupuncture. I do a lot, and I find it very beneficial. And I also have an allopathic physician as well, so I practice it myself. And Tony, with his patients, would always say, you know, go ahead and do other things that you believe support you, but do not do it instead of the other treatments that are recommended by your doctors. But do tell both people that you're doing this and that, so both know that that it is in fact integrated in you. So that's important.
The problem with a lot of the integrated medicine is, again, getting back to natural substances. There rarely have been studies that have shown what the benefits are, and more doubt cast on them recently in this last Berkeley Health newsletter. The other thing is that so many of the herbs that are sold here, number one, are imported, and they found a lot of contamination, very serious contamination, especially from China. Number two is they combine many, sometimes dozens of different elements into one medication. And we don't know how they're going to react with medicines you may be on if you're taking prescription medicines, how they react with each other, and how to test them. So it's hard to get a handle. There probably is some good stuff in there mixed with the neutral or dangerous stuff. And for me, it's hard for me to recommend because I don't know what the truth is in there and what the risks are. Yes?
I may be exaggerating Andrew Weil's position, but it seems like he blames almost everything on what he calls inflammation. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, Andrew Weil's an interesting guy because he's well trained, very interesting. He's basically put alternative medicine on much more sound footing some of the time. I have a rule now, I won't mention him specifically or in Oz, but whenever I see somebody advertising a medication, a supplement, or vitamin, or like in Oz, resveratrol, and know that he stands to make millions of dollars selling this, I have to at least question his references and go to another level of looking it up. And unfortunately, I'm sorry Andrew Weil does that too. He sells his own stuff, and I don't think that's a good thing to do. However, inflammation is the most basic body defense against attack. It's the first thing the body does to try to stave off a foreign invasion, whether it's infection or a foreign body or an injury. And it's so important to survival in evolving through the years that it's become an enormous reaction, and our bodies overreact and give us a lot of symptoms. So for the benefit of saving our lives, we may end up putting up with symptoms, pain, swelling, and so forth, that may be overshooting. That's why we take anti-inflammatories to try to suppress that a little bit. Whether everything based on inflammation, probably not.
You on a special anti-inflammatory diet and all of the
vaccines
to avoid.
Well, probably not. I would refer you to a wonderful book, you don't have enough time to talk about it all, but The Blue Zone. How many of you have read or heard about The Blue Zone? Okay. Morgan should read this book. This is an interesting topic which investigates very carefully places where people live long, healthy lives. There are about 8 or 10 of them around the world, and it's not just one thing. They're high altitude, low altitude, they're in the ocean, they're inland, they're islands, the ethnicity can be mixed, the ethnicity can be pure. It's all around, and yet these places, single places, including Long-Lived California, have extraordinary numbers of people living into the 100 and older and very healthy. And they have commonalities. All of them have the same things in regard to diet, high in fruits and vegetables, high in fiber, low in fat, but not no fat, and so on. Extended families, lots of community seems to be very important. Daily exercise, but most of these people don't exercise. They live in places or do work where they're required to a lot of physical exertion, and so on. It's worth reading this because it means you can do this without changing your life, and you can, change it dramatically, but incorporate very pleasant and beneficial lifestyle changes and get the same kind of benefits without going to a special diet. They talk about the Mediterranean diet, which is a fabulous diet. Fruits and vegetables, grains, and so on. But there's a diet like that for every sector of the world. You can get Asian food that way, and Indian food, and so on. South America has foods just like the Mediterranean diet. And you can look this up on the internet. It's easy to see what their food triangles or pyramids look like. The healthy plate, I should say.
Yeah, I've got two questions I'd like to get into. One is about the fish oil. and your opinion of taking a low-dose aspirin along with fish oil, whether that's an issue. The other one is about isolated systolic hypertension, which happens to people as they get older, naturally. I've seen a consensus recommendation in the literature that said getting systolic down to about 140 is a good target, and there's no evidence really for the benefits of going below that. Yet some doctors want to be more aggressive and get it down more in the 120 to 130 range, even if you get the diastolic down lower, which I've also read might have some dangers associated with it.
Well, the diastolic, for those of you, the systolic pressure is that upper number, and that measures the pressure at the height of the force of contraction of your heart. So when your heart beats and squeezes, all the blood vessels are filled with blood, and the arteries are very elastic, so they expand, and it's the pressure you reach during contraction or systole. The diastolic blood pressure is when the heart relaxes, which is when your heart gets fed its blood, by the way. And then there's that elastic recoil of the vessels and the pressure you reach at the bottom side. The diastolic pressure, which people don't pay as much attention to when they should, tells you a lot about the status of your vessels. Are they soft or are they hard, hardening of the arteries? If they don't have that nice recoil to them, the elasticity, then you have a high diastolic, like you may have 130. I'd rather have 150 over 70 than 120 over 90. Personally, I'd rather know my vessels have a nice diastolic softness. So in terms of isolated systolic hypertension, I'm just not an expert on those numbers. I don't know the answer. The fish oils and the aspirin. Aspirin has been well proven in mini dose to benefit patients who have had previous cardiac threats or events. It's not so well known whether it helps people prophylactically to prevent future ones if they've never had it. We do know it does seem to benefit you in terms of colon cancers and some other cancers. So again, it's something you ought to check in with your own doctor. Fish oil and mini dose aspirin, you may want to err on the side of a little less fish oil or fewer salmon.
Is flaxseed a good thing to take instead of fish oil? I started bleeding with fish oil.
My family expert on flaxseed oil.
Or flaxseed.
Right, and it's so interesting. We just had this conversation this morning. I talked to someone yesterday who said that we should only eat flaxseed that is not ground. And all along I was told you should only eat flaxseed that is ground because it's the only way the body digests it. Mm-hmm. And this woman was saying, well, if you first soak it for 15 minutes, the lovely outer shell of it comes off.
Oh.
And then you get to ingest soaked whole flaxseeds. But that's not answering your question about the fish oil. But there's a flaxseed debate that I can't answer. This is new information. I do take it. I add it to my shake every morning.
Mm-hmm.
But and I also take the fish oil. But they're different, and you spoke to this in Lifelong Health, where they give you different types of omegas.
Yeah,
you still, but if you can't take the fish oil, I mean, can you eat salmon or halibut or?
Yes,
and I think probably the flax.
You may not eat fish oil if you're having one of the cold water fishes about three times a week. You probably aren't even eating fish oil. The other thing I always like to tell patients or audience or whoever you ask or who listen. Is you'll rarely go wrong, again, Mother Nature, you'll rarely go wrong by eating or getting your supplements or your nutrition from foods. You'll get in trouble when you try to pack it all into a capsule, like the beta carotene, and take it that way, whether it's Veritrol, whatever it is. It's hard to go overboard. Now, you can do it. I had friends who were juicing carrots for their kids and their family, and they came over to them one day and said, look at this! And they held up their hands, and they were orange. That's not a good thing. You think this is terrific. It's telling you something. Your body can't get rid of all that carotene. So, again, moderation and getting your nutrition from whole food is, in my opinion, the way to do it.
So if you're not digesting well because you have like amoebic parasites, then how do you get rid of them?
Oh, I go to a doctor who specializes in tropical diseases and get flagella or whatever he or she decides to give you. In today's world of good living through chemistry, you should be able to get rid of almost any parasite. So
I'd get to a specialist, you doesn't.
Can you talk about sleep? You mentioned it's a big problem.
Too tired of the problem. Yeah, it is a real problem, and definitely, without question, in this country, we're getting not nearly enough sleep. The optimum, supposedly, is between 7 and 8 hours. The fall off of your efficiency and performance is dramatic. Again, very easy to test. They did this with college students in testing. 1 hour of less sleep a night can cause this measurable fall off in performance. And once you get down 2 or 3 hours per night of less than adequate sleep, it falls off dangerously and dramatically. Too much sleep is also a problem. And basically, most people can be helped with what they call sleep hygiene, getting rid of lights in the room and so forth. You say using bedrooms for sleep and sex, not watching TV and reading. There's a whole, if you look up sleep hygiene, that's a good place to start.
Can you explain what a probiotic food is? I have some Asian friends who eat cabbage that they say is probiotic, and they say it's healthy everything.
Well, the probiotics usually buy, like Activia, are usually refers to foods that have a high concentration of live organisms, bacteria, that are supposed to replace your abnormal bacteria. Your feces are 80% bacteria by around weight, and so they're very important that they be balanced and so forth. However, what the studies are showing is these probiotics that you buy in the food stores, not in the food like heaven, but in the food stores, generally don't seem to have much effect on your natural flora. It'll get back to where it was. Unless you have something wrong. If you have inflammatory bowel disease, or you've been on antibiotics, or something else has changed the balance of the flora in your intestine, then you can get them a head start by using probiotics. In terms of probiotics as part of food, I don't know the answer.
I did. Can you talk about Ensure
as a way to eat?
Yes.
To gain weight and keep
nutrition? No, I mean, there's a lot of doctors that prescribe it to people, and I was curious why they do that, and if you think it's a good idea.
Okay, now, we're moving away from science to personal opinions. I like to do it. I have to keep those separate. I don't know the science on Ensure. It's basically a package of nutrients put together to try to make somebody have a proper nutritional balance if they're not eating properly. I've seen it used very well by the gastroenterologists in patients who have a problem, either have celiac disease, inflammatory bowel syndrome, Crohn's disease, and so on, when the patient is failing, to try to boost their nutrition and help them through a period. In terms of long term, I don't know the answer to that. I think most nutritionists would tell you to get your nutrition from whole foods and use something like it if you're only on the short term. But then we're back to science, and I don't know the science.
About the sleep thing, I have a friend who says Benadryl is a good inducer.
It does, and it also fries your brain a bit. I used to prescribe Benadryl a lot in a hospital setting to patients who are having trouble sleeping, especially the elderly, who are afraid to use the old drugs like Nebivol, which often got them psyched up. And it really does work, especially in a higher dose. But they've now found the latest science I know about, which disturbs me because I like Benadryl for cancer. Both Ambien, which they portrayed as being relatively risk-free, and Benadryl, which we used to take like candy when I was a kid because of allergies.
Right.
And walk around in days all day, which you didn't see. And it turns out that, especially in the elderly, people above 60, Benadryl and Ambien start causing, over time, first of all, in a short period, the next day can cause inattention, somnolence, and decrease in ability to perform. But over the long term, short-term memory loss, and push you toward the side of cognitive decline that you don't want to be at. So I would say Benadryl is not a good long-term drug. None of them are.
Back on your question when you were talking about sleep,
yeah.
I know that
you take a nap, and there are studies, like the Air Force did studies on after short naps, the increase in efficiency.
Yeah, and nap is, again, one of those things about moderation. I love to nap, and we all love to nap when we're babies. And I used to nap, especially when I was still doing a lot of surgery. I'd come home for lunch and nap before my afternoon surgery. But the idea is to keep it relatively short. You definitely less than an hour, sometimes maybe a half hour, 40 minutes, and then not too close to the evening time. So people who are taking longer naps later in the day tend to have more trouble sleeping, but it is very beneficial apparently for people who take shorter naps earlier in the day.
Do you still do it?
Yeah, as much as possible.
So I have two questions. I'll ask them separately, okay? First question is, sleep, does it make a difference in terms of when you go to sleep and when you wake up? If you get your 8 hours, does it matter if you go to sleep at 2 a.m. and to 10 or?
That's apparently not.
Ah, that's good to hear.
That's Goldilocks.
Yeah.
You know, there are larks and there are owls, and I think we come onto the planet that way. We're fortunately both larks, you know, but when a lark marries an owl, then you got a problem. If you know what I mean by larks and owls, larks like to go to bed early, owls like to go to bed late.
Okay, so owls aren't wrong.
No.
No, it's just who we are. And again, it's Goldilocks, what's right for you. And sometimes people change.
Yet another question.
Another question, it's kind of, it has two parts to it. Everything's complicated in one. Part one, general question is, what can you do to prevent cognitive decline?
Okay.
And the specific question is there anything in particular you can do to prevent the loss of name, of recalling names? Because I have hundreds of names that I have to remember at any given time.
See, I don't have that problem because I've never remembered anybody's name, so I can't lose everyone. What do you think, anybody's having, what they think is the one thing you can do to prevent cognitive decline that has stood up in every single study ever done?
Exercise.
You're all that. No cognitive decline back there. 20% of your cardiac outcome, come hell or high water, goes to your brain. Everything else gets shut down. Brain mandates 20% go to it. So when you're exercising and you're increasing your cardiac output and your stroke volume, the volume that comes out with every pump of the heart, you're giving the brain all this nourishment. The brain has no reserves of glucose or energy. It has no reserves of oxygen. It needs a constant flow. Cognitive decline, aside from Alzheimer's, is usually vascular problem, the blood vessel and the decrease in blood flow to the brain. So if you just exercise even a little, get your heart rate over 100, walk, laugh, do something to increase your cardiac output, that will work. Nothing else has been proved to do it. If you do crossword puzzles every day, which I do, you just get better at crossword puzzles. All these, mind gym and mind games have been really carefully studied. They will improve the specific kind of mental attention that exercises, the mind game, but nothing else. And it's a normal part of aging to lose memory for names. Some people always have it, and some people don't. But I don't know of any supplements. Andrew Wild's been selling ginkgo and other things for years about that. And he's had to admit that, he's picked and chosen which studies he likes to quote. There's really not good evidence that you can take something. You are like,
let me just
blueberries.
Pardon?
Blueberries.
Blueberries, they're terrific. I have blueberries every day. Blueberries are fabulous, but we don't know that it'll change cognitive. It's really antioxidant, chock full of stuff.
Tony, I want to jump in here with this cognitive decline piece and ask you, Spencer. I remember reading studies about mindfulness and meditation being very helpful, and that some of the long-term, really serious meditators have incredible mind capacity. Have you read those?
I've read anecdotal stuff. But I don't, if anybody has come across or knows of a a good formal study that shows that mindfulness prevents cognitive decline. What I have heard is that mindfulness keeps the cerebral cortex thicker over time, and that presumably would prevent cognitive decline. There is that one study that shows that there's increased, you retain increased thickness in the cerebral cortex, and that would probably lead to better mental function later. That's the only one I know.
Very, very difficult to measure those things. That's why they're hard to study. And people, for example, who are meditators and have a good practice of meditation, also do other things. Remember this, these things are called, they're overdetermined, they're called confounding factors. The big study that I always get crazy about when I hear it is that moderate drinkers live longer and healthier lives. Right? That's not true. That's not true. Moderate drinkers live longer and healthier lives, but we don't know that it's from the alcohol. There's never been a study that showed it was the alcohol. What we do know is that moderate drinkers have other moderate habits.
Yeah.
They have better access to health care. They tend to be better educated and wealthier. And the people they compare to, the control group, so-called teetotalers. A big group of teetotalers are already sick. They're alcoholics. So it was a terrible study, even though it was a huge study. And if you read some of George Valiant's work on this, he was the guy I told him about this, and he's had me on the phone for an hour. Really? You're going to answer that question. He really is convinced that this has been a big sham. But over by the lighting. If you want to get resveratrol and the benefits of those things, have some grape juice. That's where the good stuff is. And then for what we do know on the other side of that, for women, with every increase in your level of alcoholic intake from zero right on up, you get an increase in the risk of breast cancer. So we know, and you don't get prevention of cardiac disease. That was an old study. So, don't always, there's a lot of things that confound the studies.
Just could you comment on hormone replacement therapy, especially for women?
We do have a whole lecture in lifelong health on it, and to quote Gertrude Stein, which we do, is there is no answer, there never has been an answer, there never will be an answer, that's the answer.
I would say medically.
It's again between you and your doctor. I take bioidentical hormone replacements that are based on yams. I have a doctor who likes them and a doctor who hates them, but they're not going to study them because, again, they're naturally derived, and so there aren't long-term studies. But from the research I've done and we've done, for me, they work for lots of reasons. So I think that is an extremely personal choice, and
The science side of that is that the risk increase happens to be a rather small risk increase. The lifestyle changes, and the bumper sticker, I have a gun and I take a bumper. The lifestyle changes may be more important to an individual than that increased risk, and for other people, the increased risk may be important. It's very, very between you and Dr. You've been raising here for a while.
Do you consider it important to have that balance between the acid and the alkaline in your body?
No, your body is absolutely perfect at doing that without you. Okay. You maintain a pH of 7.4 to come hell or high water, your kidneys, your liver, and your lungs will take care of that. And if you move off into one side or the other, it will quickly correct you.
Do you have any advice on whether we should use specialists or just a family physician? I just recently got a family physician. He doesn't seem to want to refer me to specialists, which I used to go to all the time. So I'm not sure.
Well, I think the same thing. I have a family physician down here who wanted to use specialists the first day. And I think yes, specialists are very important in their specialty. Right? Mm-hmm. And, I was against specialists, so I'm biased. But I think my first question is, how many of these did you do last week, whatever it is? And if you're not doing that specialty every single day, I don't really want you treating you. Family physician is wonderful for screening, but yes.
Can you talk about arthritis, osteoarthritis?
Well,
my husband has it really bad.
Well, osteoarthritis is very common. It's basically a wear and tear phenomenon. And almost everybody over a certain age has some joints affected by osteoarthritis. And there are lots of different ways to deal with it. The one way that isn't proven that's out there is chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine. Again, multi-billion dollar industry.
You say is or is not?
It's not proven.
It's not proven.
So we, because we have to break in about 2 minutes, you might want to maybe take one more question and then make some sort of summary statement.
Okay, you can talk. Can you raise your hand? Yes.
Can you say something about eating before you go to bed as a comfort kind of relaxant?
Yeah, eating before you go to bed in any quantity and beyond a very narrow range is probably not a good thing, especially as we, again, get older and we're prone to reflux in our sleep. So that's not a good thing. I would say try not to eat any closer than 1 to 2 hours before you go to bed, and even in very small amounts, and very neutral, not heavy fat loads, especially, which relaxes your esophagus and makes you prone to regurgitation. A lot of people in the middle of the night have reflux and regurgitation, and chronically that can be dangerous.
So,
yes,
thank you.
So maybe, again, because we have to break, okay. You might want to, if you want to make any summary statement or anything you want to tell us overall.
Well, I always think it's safe to go back to the key points. Mary Beth reminds me that moderation, not trying to fool Mother Nature, you know, do the basic, simple stuff. It doesn't take a lot. Whole foods are delicious and healthy, and you won't get in trouble. Blueberries. I mean, how bad can that be? And same thing, whether it's exercise, lifestyle, all of it. Stay moderate and stick to sound principles. Don't follow the fads. They're usually wrong.
And learn how to listen to your body, to your body, moment by moment, not what the culture is saying or what you should look like or feel like or a food or an exercise you should do. Really, I think that especially as we age, we can become more and more attuned to what's wanted right now, right here. And our body really does know if we'll listen to it.
So, we have to break it if you want to come up individually, come up really quickly.
Goodman.
G-O-O-D-M-A-N.
And good woman.